I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:13, Wednesday, January 6th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and it's early, but it seems like 2021 is not going to be a complete dumpster fire.
I second that, Joe. Congratulations on all of us making it through 2020. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And as of today, we're anxiously awaiting the results of the final U.S. Senate race. Looks like the voting is razor thin. And speaking of razors, Joe, that's quite a look for you today.
What, even my hair or my beard?
You actually, you look well coiffed. I mean, did you trip and fall into an electric razor or something? You're looking stylish.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Keeneland January Horses of All Ages Sale takes place Monday, January 11th through Thursday, January 14th. That's next week. Visit january.keeneland.com for more details on the sale, which features the dispersals of Samson Farm, Paul Pompa Jr., and Spry Family Farms. Okay, so we were not on the air to recap and react to the Malibu and a couple other big stakes over the break. I think the two headliners clearly are Charlatan and Life is Good from the races that we weren't able to cover the last few weeks. Charlatan, I was against him in that race. I thought, you know, coming off that long layoff, I had watched some of his works on XBTV, and they didn't seem to quite have the same pop that he had in the spring, but. Yeah, I was proven wrong. He blew by Nashville like he was standing still and ran away in the stretch. One eased up by about 5.5 lengths, I think, out of 107 buyer. And I think we can agree that he's the most exciting horse of 2021 at this moment, especially with a couple of recent retirements. I think, you know, the sky is the limit for him. I wonder how far he ultimately wants to go. He has not been proven beyond a mile and an eighth. And you could argue that his worst race so far was the mile and an eighth Arkansas Derby, even though he won by 6 lengths. He only got a 96 buyer. Field wasn't too good. That was obviously the weaker division of the Arkansas Derby last year. But, you know, at least going 7 furlongs or a mile, I don't see anybody on the scene right now who can beat him. It's really just a matter of him staying healthy. But it was an incredible, incredible performance in the Malibu. And then Life is Good, who ran in the Sham on Saturday. You know, I said this, we were talking about Life is Good's maiden win. I said that he seemed maybe a little bit too fast for his own good. He seemed like a little bit of a runoff speed. And I think that bore out in the Sham. You know, he still ran a big race. He got a 101 buyer, but he was getting a little leg weary late. He ran off and ran some really quick fractions. I don't know. I gotta be against him, especially if he keeps, you know, if he keeps running like this, if he keeps having these runoff races. I gotta be against him as the distances get longer. It was crazy when they had the first Derby future wager pool, and he was like the only horse in single digits. He was like something ridiculous, like 8-1. Even Essential Quality was like 18-1. So I gotta be against him going forward, but obviously he's got a lot of talent. I just think in the future, his best races are going to come around one turn. Just some thoughts from you guys about those two performances and anything else you saw.
Yeah, Joe, nothing really to add about Charlatan. I mean, everything he said, I totally agree with. He's a very, very exciting horse. It'll be very interesting to see where they go with him now. Will they go to the Pegasus? Will they entertain thoughts of going to Dubai or Saudi Arabia, that sort of thing? But yeah, until proven otherwise, he's going to be the most exciting, biggest horse in 2021. Life is Good. I don't really know what to make of him. And one of the reasons why is I'm having a flashback. I think a lot of people are to Authentic, who won the same race. And there are some similarities there that, you know, Life is Good looks green, looks like he still needs to learn. And you had that same thing last year with Authentic. And I was one of the first guys to say, oh, Authentic will never go a mile and a quarter, et cetera. So I'm a little bit gun shy to say anything negative about Life is Good. So let's just look at the positives. The buyer number was really good. And maybe this horse that finished second behind him, Medina Spirit, just ran out of his skin. I mean, they did have 13 lengths back on the third place finisher. Yes, I think Life is Good is going to go forward, do I think he's a cinch to win the Kentucky Derby? Of course not. We have to see more. And yes, you would like to see him run a little bit of a more settled race where, you know, he's not running 44 and change or something like that. But I think he passed the test, and I'll be anxious to see what he does in his next race, which would likely be the San Felipe.
And I think when you watch these two races, you have to remember, you know, something, and that is both horses are still lightly raced and still unseasoned. So it's really not a surprise that Life Is Good, who that was only his second start of his career, is still kind of we're learning about him. He's learning about how to race, maybe how to rate a little bit, and maybe has some upside. And Bill, you're 1,000% correct. I think we all learned a really difficult lesson with Authentic last year, all the way through, you know, midway through his three-year-old year, where we kept poo-pooing him and saying, ah, he can't go further, he can't go further, when in reality, obviously he did. And, you know, no one's to say that Life Is Good is as good as Authentic. But certainly you have to give, you know, these young horses a little bit of time to kind of learn their craft and learn what to do. And then we can get a better idea of, you know, how they're going to unfold as they develop in, you know, in their three-year-old year. Again, this was only his second start of his career. And it was a really impressive one. He was, you know, getting a little leg weary at the end. But that's not unusual for, you know, for a horse that runs long for the very first time. Flipping ahead, or flipping back, I should say, to the Malibu, you know, I remember looking at the field and even commenting on the podcast about how, hey, this is a great race on paper. You have Independence Hall, who was, you know, the first or second choice in you know, a lot of his races as a two-year-old and early three-year-old, including some of the Derby preps. Collusion Illusion, who won the Bing Crosby, which was a grade one. Thousand Words, the $1 million horse, who, you know, won his first three starts. Nashville, who I was on the big, you know, I still am on the Nashville bandwagon, you know, running a hole in the wind during all three of his first starts. And then you have, oh, by the way, Charlton, who was you know, technically undefeated, and Express Train, who finished second in the race. And it just turned out to be a very, you know, very well run race for, you know, for the six horses that were in there. They were all very deserved. So I was impressed when Charlton ran the way he did with, you know, winning the way he did and running a 107 buyer. And, you know, the 7 furlongs, one turn mile is probably going to be his, you know, his sweet spot. Nashville, you know, no excuse other than, you know, maybe you say, okay, he ran three times back to back to back very quickly on all the big race days. And then they shipped them across country, you know, to run in California. But the majority of these horses shipped across country to run, you know, in this race. So, you know, you don't like to give him that kind of an excuse, but I'm still a Nashville fan. I'm still looking forward to him sprinting and running, you know, keeping it at three quarters for most of this year. And you know, it would be interesting to see if they would ever turf him, being that he's a Spikestown of a mizzen-mast mare. You would wonder, hey, maybe he would, you know, could he get better on the turf? That would be a question that I would like to see answered in 2021.
Couple other things from that race. You mentioned Express Train, who I thought ran really well to be second in there. I think he's an interesting horse going forward, kind of a late developing three-year-old. Nashville, you know, I don't know what conclusion to draw from that race with him. Now, do you just throw it out, or do you, you know, dock him points for that? Because he gave it up. Like, I understand the fractions were very, very fast, but he gave it up with no resistance at all. Like, by the top of the stretch, he was toast. And I say that as someone who leaned on Nashville more so because I was against Charlton in that race. And I just, you know, I wonder whether or not it was too much too soon for him. Maybe he just doesn't want to go a step beyond 6 furlongs. But he, you know, sometimes really fast sprinters, they're not the same horse when they get eyeballed, when they can't just pop out to the front and, you know, stay in front for the whole race and not really have anybody ever breathing down their neck or looking them in the eye. I think that a lot of times there'll be different horses when they do get that pressure. So we'll see. You know, his first three starts, he was too fast for everybody he lined up against. That's not going to be the case all the time. He was too fast early in the Malibu, but really just had nothing in the stretch. So it's going to be interesting to see where he shows up next, and if he's able to bounce back, because I thought it was, as the two stories of the race, as good as Charlatan was, I thought it was a pretty bad performance by Nashville. And you know, it's obviously early days for him, but I think that that's something he's going to need to bounce back from. On the Life Is Good front, I think, you know, even though I'm skeptical about him derby wise, I think there's, you know, there's enough context to say that he's really good whether or not it's, you know, shorter or whatever, beyond the 101 buyer he got, beyond the obvious speed he shows. If you look at his debut race and the horses that have come back to run, the runner-up in that race ran a 71 buyer behind Life is Good, came back and ran an 88 buyer graduating next time out. And then the fourth horse, Roman Centurion, who I think he ran a 65 behind Life is Good. He came back on Sunday, and I made him a TDN Rising Star. He got an 80 buyer in his maiden win on Sunday, but it was visually more than anything. He was caught wide on both turns, and the race did fall apart a little bit in his lap. There was a fast pace, but he really was finishing and really motored home. So I think, you know, as time goes on, we're going to see that race was super, super live. So that flatters Life is Good, obviously. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. All right, so we had the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, the HISA, depending on how you want to say it, pass last Monday night. It was late Monday night when the coronavirus relief package was signed into law. So that was kind of a formality once it was included in that bill. But obviously it's a big deal for the industry. There's a lot still to be determined. It's not going to go into effect until July 2022. So there's a good amount of time to figure out how this thing is going to work. We're going to talk to the president of the Jockey Club, Jim Gagliano, in a little bit and ask him questions and get a better handle on how this thing is going to shake out. But the main thing I think that everybody is talking about and the main sticking point is how this is going to be paid for. And it's going to be pretty expensive once you bring in USADA to do all the drug testing. There was an article this week in the TDN about, you know, how much exactly it's going to cost. And it seems like it's going to be upwards of $20 million to do all this testing at least. And then you also have to pay people on the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority. It's going to get expensive pretty quickly, I think. And this is not an industry that has a lot of spare money lying around. It's just, you know, we're kind of scrimping as it is these days. And you know, the main thing I think that the main takeaway, and Bill wrote about this a little bit, is that there are two groups that you can't really tax any more than they've been taxed already in this industry, and that's owners and horse players. And I'm going to stand up for horse players because I think there are some owners who can afford to pay a little more, but that gets tricky because most owners, you know, I think are barely scraping by. But you know, you can't raise takeout. You can't do it. I'm worried that this is going to be, you know, kind of the de facto way to pay for this is to increase the pricing on betting horses, and it's just you can't do it. People are squeezed to the last drop as it is, and I'm like, you know, I'm obviously an advocate for racing and for playing the horses, but I'm like kind of at my wit's end with the takeout and all the stuff that comes with betting the horses. And it's just, if you jack it up anymore, you're going to lose a lot of customers, and then you're going to be in a bigger hole than you were before this thing happened. So there's no easy answers. I'm curious to get Bill and John's thoughts about how this might be paid for. But my thought would be that you just can't take it out of horse players' pockets. We're bleeding money enough as it is.
Well, I mean, first of all, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the last place they should take the money is from the horse players, because they are the most important segment of this game, with them and owners together. 1 and 1A, and horse players are getting blood dry as it is. But the problem, Joe, as you said, is, you know, where is the money going to come from? There's no group in horse racing where you could say, oh, you guys are doing great, you can pay for it. Horse players aren't, owners certainly aren't. Racetracks, you know, they don't generally make any money running racing. You know, it's different with casinos, but you're not going to take it, obviously, from the casino money. So how is this all going to break down? And we'll get more from Jim Gagliano when we talk to him. But it looks like what they're going to do is they're going to first figure out how much this is going to cost. And that's just anybody's guess at this point. I mean, I wouldn't even begin to know what kind of number to throw out. And then they're going to go to divide it up by each individual state based on how many, how much racing there is in that state. So Pennsylvania with three racetracks is going to have to pay more than Arkansas with one racetrack, Oakland. I'm guessing that the states are going to then say, maybe we have to have a starter fee. So is that $100 for a horse to start? Is it $150 a horse? This is all just general speculation. But the states have to come up with a way of how they're going to pay for it. And I think the easiest way to do that is just have some sort of starter fee. But, you know, I'd like to see what John has to say about this as an owner. I mean, even a good stable with some very good horses like his, could they afford to pay $200 every single time they start a horse? So, John, I'll hand it off to you and see what you have to say about that.
Yeah, you know, Bill, this was actually brought to my attention a little while ago about, hey, how are you going to pay for this, you know, very important bill and obviously a ruling. Obviously, it's something that the industry needs, and it's something that the industry has been lacking for years and years and years. And I even went through in anticipation of our interview today with Jim Gagliano, I went through actually some of the transcripts of the Jockey Club meetings, the roundtable meetings they have every year. And as recently as 2018, in that roundtable conference, one of the issues that that the McKinsey report came out with was the fact that owners and horse players are losing confidence in the integrity of the game. And that was in 2018. So if you want to, you know, say, well, we're fixing the integrity issue, but oh, it's going to cost you a tax in essence to do it. You know, some people may be okay with it, but I think the vast majority doesn't want to have, you know, another governmental agency have their hand in their pocket. So a starter fee, even if it's a minor one, like a couple hundred dollars, that greatly changes the landscape for a lot of these outfits and a lot of these owners, where they say, maybe I don't want to run the horse again, you know, and then it's going to get to the point of, well, I'm going to enter my horse, I'm going to look at it, and if I'm 10, 15, 20 to one and really don't feel like I have a chance, then I'm going to scratch, and it's going to cause havoc for the racing, you know, offices of all the respective racetracks, because they're not going to know, we entered 12, are six going to run, are eight going to run, and then it's going to affect the product, and then people aren't going to bet on it, and so on and so forth. So I don't know if that's necessarily the best way to do it. The cynic in me says that depending on who is going to be in the roundtable discussion, as far as how to pay for this is going to, you know, greatly affect who gets taxed for it. I say with all sincerity, if it's a bunch of people that are farm owners and breeders, then the racing operations are going to be the ones that pay for it. And if it's a racing operation group that dominates the roundtable discussion, then it's going to be the farms and the sales companies that are going to take the brunt of the tax. But overall, the entire industry has to realize that HISA is really important to the longevity of the sport and the integrity of the sport, because we've proven time and time again, and we've talked about it over and over again on this podcast, that we just don't have the wherewithal or the interest or the desire to self-regulate. So this is what happens when you can't self-regulate your own industry. Government comes in and it costs you money because you guys, me included, as part of the racing product, weren't able to kind of police yourselves. And you get taxed for it now.
Yeah. I don't know. There's so much big money in this industry that it's going to be a hard sell to ask horse players to take another hit on top of, you know, the already exorbitant takeout they're paying, you know, on a regular basis. I understand that, you know, owning horses is also, and owning farms can also still be a, you know, an economically tough business, but there is so much big money and so many billionaires in this industry that, you know, it's going to have to come from the top, I think. Otherwise you're going to lose a lot of the bread and butter of your industry, which is the horse players. And I'm interested to talk to Jim about that and see what he says, see what his thoughts are going forward. But I just think, you know, it would be a disaster to take it out of the horse players' pockets. And, you know, I don't know that racing would really recover from that. You're hanging on to your customer base by a thread as it is. It's got to come from somewhere else. I don't have any great ideas at the moment. Bill had an interesting idea about breakage. Now breakage, if you're unfamiliar, is, you know, this is like a hidden tax on horse players already as it is. Breakage is the payouts are rounded down to the nearest either 10 cents or 20 cents. So if you bet a horse and the horse wins and should pay $4.58, you're going to get $4.40 back. Now that adds up over time. That those 18 cents, you know, over all of the winning wagers across the country for the whole year, that adds up to millions and millions of dollars. Now there are other sources that the breakage money is getting sent to, but I thought that was an interesting idea by Bill and you know, kind of an outside the box thought, because, you know, it's not going to be easy to come up with a way to pay for this, but, you know, there is bloat in this industry. You just got to find it. And I felt like that was one of the places, but, you know, there might be too many people that are benefiting from that right now that aren't willing to give up that handout, which is basically what it is, a handout on the backs of horse players. All right. So we had some big news. We teased this in our final 2020 show. We said we were interested to see what the final 2020 handle numbers would be. And they were released yesterday by Equibase. It's a remarkable thing that wagering was somehow down only 0.98% in 2020. And I think that's one of the good news stories of horse racing in 2020 and going forward. The total handle was $10.925 billion in 2020 compared to $11.033 billion in 2019. So essentially flat. The big difference was in wagering per race day, because there were fewer race days. There were 3,302 race days in 2020 compared to 4,425 in 2019. So that's a big drop off, 25.38%. So average wagering per race day was 3.3 million compared to 2.4 million. Now that's a huge, huge difference. You know, and you could say, you know, people were just betting the same money that they were going to bet anyway. And they, you know, they had this amount of money budgeted to wager, and they just had fewer days to do it. But I think that kind of oversells the forethought of gamblers to have this set budget, you know, for the year and to never stray from it, no matter what. I think it's generally more of a, you know, go by feel as the year goes on type of thing. But you know, regardless of whether it was just the same money divvied up differently, the fact that wagering was essentially flat when overall you have economic conditions that are the worst since the Great Depression. Now, obviously, things are going to get better once the pandemic starts to wane. But, you know, to have that kind of economic downturn and to still have wagering be essentially flat in 2020 is a big, big deal potentially for horse racing. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, once as the calendar turns into 2021, to see the first quarter numbers in 2021, the first half numbers in 2021. But we don't love to be pessimists, but we're forced to be pessimists sometimes on the show. I don't see how you could be pessimistic about these numbers. I'm curious to see what Bill has to say.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not bad news. That's obviously, I mean, down 0.98%, less than 1%. You can't look at that and say, oh, in any way, shape or form, this is bad news for racing. But Joe, I still don't know what it means. And does it mean that racing picked up all these new customers? And, you know, maybe it picked them up when the NBA, the NHL, and Major League Baseball wasn't going. People didn't have anything to watch on TV. They watched horse racing on TV. They didn't have anything else to bet on. We're not going to know that until 2021 numbers start to come in. So if 2021 numbers grow, and, you know, something significant, not 1%, but, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10%, then we're going to have the answer. Yes, one of the silver linings to the cloud of 2020 was that horse racing picked up some new customers and the product grew. But I'm not convinced that it's not just smaller slices of the pie or bigger slices of the pie, that you do have this money out there. And it's not so much that horse players plan their budgets or anything like that, but, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, if there's 10 tracks running, are you going to bet more than if there are 8 tracks running? No, you're just going to bet the same amount of money, but it's going to be divided up among the 8 tracks or the many tracks that you're betting on. So, you know, let's see what happens here. Hopefully it's really good news, and it could be really good news for horse racing, but, you know, there's just too many factors, too many unknowns for 2020, too many balls up in the air. I think for anybody to really to be able to come up with a concrete answer of what this meant.
Guys, I got to look at this as a half empty kind of situation where, you know, we were the only game in town. We were literally the only game in town for months and months and months. And we couldn't convince more people to bet more on our sport. I mean, I understand there's a pandemic and COVID and people losing their jobs, and those are all very legitimate factors, you know, when you're analyzing this. But come on, there was no way for any of these, you know, gamblers to bet on anything else other than horse racing, and we're flat. To me, that's kind of a negative. I mean, you know, people told me years and years and years, you know, decades ago, that the only three businesses that are recession proof are bars, churches, and racetracks. And, you know, this the teeth of COVID put us in basically a recession like situation, and we were flat or maybe down a little bit. To me, that doesn't bode well, because I think that these gamblers, you know, took their money and went to football when football reopened, and went to basketball when college basketball reopened. And now I think we're going to start seeing our numbers come back to the levels that they were at before. So we as an industry had an opportunity to capture new fans and capture new people by literally being the only game in town, and we didn't.
Jesus, I try to bring a little ray of sunshine into the show every once in a while, and I just, you can't do it with these guys. They always find the negative.
Joe, I gotta tell you, in my years of being a certified financial planner, you know, I would always, like, you know, tell people, okay, you need to have a certain amount of money for, like, you know, your essentials, certain amount of money for a vacation fund, certain amount of money for entertainment, for gambling. I think, I don't know if people were that, you know, savvy or conscious of what they were doing, but like you guys said before, they were probably betting, you know, the same amount in 2020. But if ESPN, the Ocho, threw up cockroach racing and made it wagerable, you know, I think people would bet on that, especially if they thought of, you know, one of the bugs was juiced.
I don't know. I mean, I can only speak to my own experience, but I definitely bet less in 2020 just because, you know, you got to be a little bit more careful with your money when there's something as catastrophic as the pandemic happening. So I don't know. I mean, that's just me. That's just anecdotal. But I have to think there were a lot of people that were not being as, they weren't being spendthrift the way they normally are on horse racing. I don't know. I find it hard to believe that this is a negative story. Now we're going to learn more as 2021 moves on and we get more handle numbers for this year. But I don't know. I disagree with John. I don't think there's any way to look at this as a negative. I think at worst it's a wash. But there's the discussion to be had is whether or not we gain new customers, and that's a hard thing to figure out. You know, there's no data, at least that I'm aware of. Maybe with ADWs, you could, you know, call up Naira Betts and see if they got a bunch of new signups or whatever. But other than that, I don't know how easy it is to figure out how many new people are betting on the game. And obviously that's the biggest metric of all, whether or not we're just maintaining the existing customer base or expanding it. But I would have, you know, if you had told me at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, horse racing wagering is going to be essentially flat in 2020, I would have said, how is that possible? How are we not down 10-15% because of everything that's going on in the world? So, yeah, I mean, I agree with John in that, you know, I don't think we capitalized as much as we should have on being the only game in town there for a while. But I think there's also a lot of good news from the handle numbers in 2020. And it's, you know, we're going to get more context later this year, but that's what I get for being the ray of sunshine on this show. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
All right, so in this week's edition of Shady Trainer that was given a ninth life in racing, we have the illustrious return of Marcus Vitale. If you don't know who Marcus Vitale was, he's a guy who was banned for, I think, at least 4 months at Gulfstream. He was banned for an entire year in Delaware for grabbing something out of the fridge when they were raiding his barn and then running away, which sounds like something like Bugs Bunny would do. But he's back. Just like other guys in racing, you can always find a jurisdiction or a racing commission that doesn't really care who you are or what your past is. You can always have a ninth or 10th chance in racing. And Marcus Vitale has resurfaced at Turf Paradise in Arizona. So this is obviously a drum that we beat a lot in racing about how, there's no coordination or cooperation between different racing commissions to keep guys like this out of the game. Now he was actually just in the news recently getting another guy ruled off the grounds. Like, that's how toxic he is, that Wayne Potts was allegedly the program trainer for him in Maryland, and they ruled, and Sal Sinatra, a friend of the show, ruled Wayne Potts off just for being associated with Marcus Vitale. And yet, a couple months later, Marcus Vitale himself, under his name, is now racing horses again. And I feel like it's a broken record. Like, you laugh, but it's not funny. It's Groundhog Day, I feel like, in racing when it comes to these things. And you only get so many chances in sports normally, in other sports at least. Just look at the quarterback of the Washington football team, Dwayne Haskins. He was in a strip club during COVID, and they cut him like a week later. And this is something that happens in other sports. You have a very, very short leash to demonstrate that you are responsible enough and upstanding enough to be part of the sport. And in racing, we don't have the people who have that kind of integrity to say, no, sorry, you've done all of these other things, we don't want you on our grounds. Bill reported this yesterday. I'm wondering if he has any further thoughts.
Yo, what is there to say at this point? I mean, honestly, I'd like to wax eloquent about this situation, but yeah, broken record, Groundhog's Day. Look, everybody deserves a second chance. Maybe everybody deserves a third chance, but this guy was asking for about his 37th chance, and someone said, yes, sure, come on in, train horses there. No, he should not be able to race horses. And we'll, a year from now on show 209, we'll be talking about Trainer X coming back after being suspended 14 times at track B. Of course we will. It just goes on and on and on. But it is amazing that the racing just perpetuates this situation and lets these guys who, whatever you want to call them, shady, but people that really should not be participating in the game, and they do come back. So again, let's just say it is what it is. And, I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
And here's the thing, I was looking on Twitter last night, people, me included, were actually tweeting out to Turf Paradise saying, really, is this really the look that you want to have to allow a guy like this embrace him into your training corps? And really they got no response. And finally, somebody from the PR department said, hey, you can't really yell at me. I'm just the guy putting the tweet out there. I'm a lowly guy in the PR, talk to management. And he's not wrong in that sense, but somebody from management should at least come out and have a statement of either saying, hey, we went through our due diligence process and we felt that he paid his sentence and his penance, and therefore we're giving him another chance, because in America, you're allowed to have you know, second, third, fifth, 18th chances. You know, I remember, Bill, you'll back me up on this. There was a pitcher, Steve Howe, who had a substance abuse problem, you know, pitched for the Dodgers and the Yankees. And he had a plethora because he could still throw it 99 miles an hour. And, you know, teams wanted to have that kind of talent on it. And they knew the baggage they were getting. I don't know if Turf Paradise really sees Vitaly as such a tremendously, you know, a tremendous trainer that they need to have him as a name, you know, for their racetrack. Because really all they're getting right now is controversy. And I even went so far as to pull the actual Arizona State licensing questionnaire for owners and trainers. And right here on the second page, there's a question that says, has your racing license ever, and it's underlined, I'm not making this up, it's underlined, ever been denied, suspended, or revoked? Yes or no? So he either willingly, fraudulently put no, and they said, we're rubber stamping it because there's no, you know, yeses, affirmatives on the questionnaire. Or he put yes, and the Arizona, you know, licensing department failed in their due diligence to actually look up and see whether or not, you know, what the issues were. And if they did, they would have had to have had a hearing in order to grant him his license. So somewhere, somebody screwed up, either the trainer wantingly put, false information down, which I don't think he did. He probably did a lot to the horses, but I'm sure he went into this going, well, they're probably going to check me out, so I better just come clean and put yes. And if he did put yes, then Arizona dropped the ball by actually granting him a license without having any kind of hearing and any kind of criminal background check on it. And if they didn't, then they need to come out and say, we did our due diligence and we think this guy is a plus and a pro part of Turf Paradise Racing. Embrace it then.
Yeah, I mean, this is where Bill's reporting is so crucial, and where like us talking about this is a big deal, because otherwise, you know, obviously there's a social media backlash, but there's got to be some kind of public outrage about this kind of thing. And you know, we I feel like we go through it all the time with just, you know, replace the trainer's name of a guy who should not be around horses and just gets chance after chance. I said it before, but it feels like the only guy who really got punished through all these years is Rick Dutrow. And even then, there are some people who are like, bring Rick Dutrow back. But like everyone else, you just get a slap on the wrist, spin him around and point him towards a different racing jurisdiction. And it's a new day for Marcus Vitaly. So, yeah, I mean, that's not good. Not good.
It's racing's version of pin the tail on the donkey. You're right.
We have to do better.
Around and throw him back into a different jurisdiction.
We got to do better. I feel like we had a graphic for that. We have to do better. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is a guy we've been trying to get on for a while. We're thrilled to finally have him on, the president and the COO of the Jockey Club, Jim Gagliano. Thanks so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Happy Great to have you. Looking forward to this conversation. So I'll start with the big news of the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. Obviously, a watershed moment for racing going forward, I think, if it's handled correctly. But a lot of people are talking about how it's going to be paid for. And I don't expect you to have all the answers because it's a complex discussion. I was saying I think it should not come out of horse players' pockets at all. But what would be your recommendation and your ideas for how we pay for this thing?
Well, I would agree with you, Joe. I don't think it should come out of the horse players' pockets. Every state funds its regulation differently. And the problem that we faced when we were considering that matter is there's really no one size fits all that we could push down to the states. The most important thing we wanted to do is make sure we captured first the current expenses, the current costs, and that those were brought forward. After that, the authority will work with each state and through its racing commission and determine what the number is. I suggest, you know, the simplest way is to share it between the tracks and the horsemen. But, you know, honestly, there's a lot of details to be considered. That's a very simple answer. Again, every state funds it a little bit differently, so it's going to be unique to each state.
Hey, Jim, thanks for joining us and thanks for the insight. the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. So you just said something that I thought was very noteworthy, that the Jockey Club really does not want to see the money come from horse players, which is great news for all horse players and the three of us here on there. But if you take the money from the tracks and the horsemen, let's not deal with the tracks at this point. Do you see that as some sort of per start fee? And on top of that, well, horse players can't afford it. Owners can't afford it either. We all know that, because owning a racehorse is a very difficult proposition if you're trying to make money. So, you know, just your general thoughts on what kind of burden it might be if there is a start fee put in and owners do have to pay for it.
Well, let's start with what we're trying to get accomplished here. And this bill will bring a once in a 100 years change in the way the sport's regulated. You know, the advantages are it'll be a level playing field. We don't have that now. You know, we've seen from the indictments, from other other things, just read your social media, lots of concerns about it not being a level playing field. And it's our honest view that in 18 months, when this new authority is established and USADA is put in the enforcement role that is designated for them, that we'll see a significant change. Some of those owners that have been running second for a long time are going to have a better chance. So it's an expense, no doubt. I'm certainly sympathetic. We put out our numbers yesterday. While handle was within 1% of the previous year, purses are way down, and you know that is an issue. But we think this is an expense the industry has to make. I don't know who's in New Jersey today. I guess John and Bill probably are. Let's take Monmouth Park. They had about 5,000 starts last year. Our estimates back in 2015, when we looked at this with McKinsey and USADA and a couple state regulators to understand what the costs could potentially be. And again, this is a few years ago and it needs to be updated. It was between $30 and $45 a start. Let's just use that as a number. So it's a couple $100,000 in New Jersey. If that's split between the horseman and the track, to me, it doesn't sound like a terrible burden.
And Jim, you know, you bring up a good point with the McKinsey report. It was something that I read with great interest, because they came in after years and years of study and basically said, hey, you know, the health of the industry is at risk right now. And I give you and the Jockey Club a tremendous amount of credit for being proactive and trying to resuscitate certain parts of the industry and trying to get us back on course in order to make this a viable industry, you know, for our kids and generations to come. And one of the things that the McKinsey report also came out with was they talked about, you know, the integrity of the sport with regard to owners and gamblers and people just losing faith in our business. Aside from HISA, are there other plans or other things that the Jockey Club is going to address or sees it in their radar that needs to be discussed, you know, over the coming years?
Well, I'm sure there's plenty. How we market the sport along with other professional sports was something that they identified in the opportunity of television, which thank goodness we took that, we, the industry, took that advice and during this pandemic to see the amount of live televised hours of horse racing has been a godsend. We talked about scheduling. Bill, you know, from our early days working together, every Saturday was a big day. Now we need to look at racing schedules, weekly schedules, seasonal schedules differently. And we need to put the product in a place where it can have the best, we can be showcased best for ADWs. But other areas of, clearly HISA is going to put USADA and into a role. There are now rules that will be in place that will, you know, change the sport, we believe. But back to the investigations, that's something that racing has not done very well over the last bunch of years. And I anticipate that the Jockey Club will continue to invest in those kind of resources to make sure that the things that we don't want to happen in our sport don't happen.
A little bit of a follow-up question on that. When it comes to drug enforcement in the industry, I think a big problem, and I think you would agree, a lot of people would agree in the industry, is that there are so many splinter groups and so many different factions. You guys are one of the unifying groups in racing, but obviously you have limited power. How do you think that your role, what do you think your role is right now in terms of cleaning up the sport? And how do you think, if at all, it'll change once the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act goes into effect?
Well, it won't change the general policy, which is we're going to do what we think is best for the sport, for the betterment of the racing and the breeding industries. So we'll continue to make those investments every year. We certainly are happy to see HISA now made law and signed by the president. So that's a big burden that's now going to come into play. And but back to investigations and things like that, we'll continue to invest in those kind of activities.
Hey, Jim, before you came on, the three of us were discussing a particular incident, a particular person racing in Marcus Vitale. And I'm not sure how much you're aware of the story, so forgive me if I'm telling you something you already know. But I'm sure you know about his background, many, many suspensions, including a year suspension in Delaware. He resurfaced just the other day at Turf Paradise after being effectively out of racing for a year and a half. All three of us came to the same conclusion. This just isn't right. Someone like this has proven that they really should not, in our opinion, be someone who should be allowed to take part in the sport. So sort of a two-part question. Could you just reflect on racing's inability to permanently do away with some of the people that are breaking the rules time and time again? And in any way, could this change with USADA and the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act?
Definitely. So what's been the limiting factor is each of the states have their own racing commissions. They can only govern what happens in their particular state. They may attempt to have reciprocity, but that's not always the case. Now, under a new federal system, a new umbrella, that those things will be looked at for the entire United States, not just in New Jersey or Arizona specifically. So it's a dawn of a new day.
Yeah, no, it future's bright in that sense, as far as having a unified body to oversee, some of the rules and regulations, because obviously as an industry, we weren't able to do that. And one of the rules actually that the Jockey Club implemented this year in June was the 140 mare rule, which I think we all agree, Jim, that we needed to have something to curb the inbreeding that was going on in the industry. A lot of people have asked us, why 140 was the magic number. And I know you guys did tremendous studies with geneticists and scientists to figure out, the actual number itself. Can you give us kind of a behind the curtain look as to why 140 as opposed to 40, which was the magic number when you and I got into the business, 30 years ago, or 250, which some of the farms are doing now?
I'm not going to go too much into what the stewards deliberated specifically. I'll just say that they had available to them lots of public research that you've all had an opportunity to examine. They had a chance to get months and months of comment from many breeders, professionals, and they weighed all that. And on top of that, they had a chance to look at the data, the numbers, and that's the number they came up with. They voted unanimously to support it, and that is the requirement now.
I'm just curious, just to jump in for a second, when you watch a race and it's won by a horse that is like a complete outcross, like a California Chrome or something like that, are you rooting for a horse like that just to kind of help the gene pool a little bit?
That does not go into my calculus. So. Whatever I do, it's probably the wrong choice. So
fair enough.
I wanted to ask, because you mentioned marketing the sport a little bit before, and you also mentioned handle. We talked about it before you came on, that it was, at least I thought, John was being negative, I thought it was a pretty good sign that that handle was basically flat in 2020, considering the economic conditions. But I'm wondering if you guys have done any research or any studies to try to determine whether or not we did gain any new customers in 2020 when we did have the spotlight to ourselves. And if not, what do you think we need to do going forward to increase the customer base?
So anecdotally, talking to colleagues in the sport that were responsible for ADW business, clearly they were signing up many more customers than they had in the past. And it's interesting the way racetracks marketed in the past. It was really there was broadcast ads and billboards and things like that, but they really didn't do a good job of capturing the data about horse players. There was this belief, well, they don't want their information to be shared. Well, now all of those new customers that signed into ADWs, all that data is captured. And just like any other new marketing methods, it's using that data, trying to understand what you like, what you don't like, what you'd be attracted to. So I think there's some tremendous opportunities with that new digital marketing opportunity. And when we get back to opening racetracks and getting back to live attendance at places like Monmouth, which still to this day attract crowds and make new fans, I think there's a couple of good things happening here.
Hey Tim, I want to go back to the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, and one of the interesting things about it was for several years it didn't appear to be really going anywhere inside Washington, and that all changed when Mitch McConnell came out and they had that press conference at Keeneland where he supported it. But prior to that, the conventional wisdom was that McConnell was not in favor of this because Churchill Downs was not in favor of it, and McConnell was going to not cross Churchill Downs. Then all of a sudden, Churchill Downs is on board, McConnell is on board, and then the thing just flies through. Well, they had some bumps in the road, but not a lot. The thing flies through Congress and is passed. Behind the scenes, what's your understanding of what happened there? How did we go from the situation where McConnell apparently wasn't in favor of it, that meant the bill was going nowhere, to where he was in favor of it and Churchill Downs was in favor of it as well?
Well, I think if you recall that press conference at Keeneland when Leader McConnell spoke, he referred to reading an article in the Washington Post which questioned whether or not thoroughbred racing has a future. And as a Kentuckian, and as a follower of the sport and recognizing its importance to the Commonwealth, he was disturbed by that. He asked us and others to come together and see if they could compromise. And you mentioned Churchill Downs. I give them all the credit in the world for coming to the table in the way they did. I think in the end, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act is a far better bill than the initial one. It goes further. It does more. It is based on a certain set of rules that are understood, and it empowers USADA specifically to be the enforcement agency. So it was a coming together moment for a lot of us in recognizing that we needed to make changes. And I credit Leader McConnell and his incredibly capable staff for being the catalysts, but I also commend everybody who worked basically through the pandemic and came up with the compromises, including animal welfare groups, including racetracks, racing organizations, associations. It was a group effort. And today you look at U.S. politics and all the discord. It's pretty cool to think that so many groups came together to support this act. And I think it was a proud day for the sport.
No question about it. And something that we've needed as an industry for years and years to come. And I don't have any other questions, Jim, other than to thank you for your leadership and for the Jockey Club being one of the unifying groups within the industry. And we need more collaboration. If there's a silver lining in any of this COVID situation, is that 2020 racetracks came together to work on calendars, and boards and groups that normally were at odds with each other came together. And we need more of that. So we all appreciate, all of us in the industry appreciate your leadership with this.
Well, it's a lot of folks that came together. So we all appreciate that, and we thank you for your comments.
All right, so we're thankful for Jim's time, and he's got to get out of here. But he has one thing that he wanted to show us about our friend Bill Finley.
1987, Bill, the Red Bank steeplechase event where you were the paddock judge and I was the observer.
Look at that
suit in the closet yesterday.
Very nice. Very nice.
I've never seen Bill wear anything but a hoodie or a zip-up sweater.
Looked pretty sharp that day.
Yep. Oh boy.
So. That's back when Bill was a real turf rider. Now he's just a talking head.
Yeah.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for the time. And thank you guys at the Jockey Club for all your hard work. And we look forward to hearing more from you guys the rest of the year and in the future.
Thanks, guys. Happy New Year again.
Thanks, Jim. You too.
Appreciate it. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Jim Gagliano will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So this week, or last week, this week, it's been announced. I had the distinct honor of being given an Eclipse Award for John's face. John's the only one that didn't know, so I was waiting for that. Last year around Belmont time, I did a story about New York and COVID and overcoming all that and kind of beating back the pandemic in order to have sports again and have Belmont again and Belmont Stakes Day. And it was a really personal story. It's probably one of the most personal stories I've ever written. And I was really proud of it, but then it got even better because Patty and her incredible team of editors worked on a video version of it. And if you haven't watched it, you should go watch it right now. I'll put the link in my Twitter bio. It's beautiful. It's 50-50 to make you cry. I got to admit, I got a lot of DMs about people having, emotional reactions to it. And that to me was the most rewarding thing because it was the story of my city and its perseverance. And, people from all over the country, wrote to me and talked about how much it moved them. So that was, it was such a terrible year and such a tragic year that I was immensely grateful and humbled to be able to tell people this inspirational story of my city. So thankfully, everybody at the Eclipse Awards and Jim Cluxton and everybody that's involved there saw it as good enough to be deserving of an Eclipse Award. And I have to hand it off to Patty right now because she is going to deflect the credit, but she and her team deserve at least 50% of the credit, if not more.
I couldn't disagree more. Could not disagree more. We fleshed out Joe's words. They were poignant and they came at a moment in time where everybody needed them. And as did the Belmont Stakes. So it was just a great, great moment in time. I won't take credit away from Anthony LaRocca, who's always puts his heart into every edit. But Joe, I will deflect almost entire credit back to you because it was your words that moved the whole thing. Thank you.
I don't know. This is Patty's second Eclipse Award. So, once is a fluke, 2 times is a trend. And I wouldn't be surprised if she and her team won another one going forward. But yeah, so just I'm very humbled and very grateful. And it's something that I could not have even imagined a couple of years ago. 5 years ago, I was doing some crappy perma freelance work at CBS Sports. And, thankfully, Sue and everybody at TDN took a chance on me. And it's worked out. It's an honor. And I'm happy to share it with you guys, especially John, to see that reaction.
I got to tell you, with all sincerity, Joe, I mean, I know we joke around a lot on the show and we take, shots at each other and it's all in good fun and out of love. I'm so proud of you. I'm genuinely, genuinely excited for everyone on the team. But most importantly, again, I don't know if you know this, but I went to school as a journalism major. And I know that the things that I wrote from the heart, I thought, went and transposed to the written word so much better. And when I read that piece of yours, you could just feel not only the love for the sport, but the love for the city. And it came out and it came through and just really was, your best work that I've ever read. And I'm just so proud that so many people out in the world have read it and commented to you and that it's getting the recognition, not only from people in the industry and outside of the industry, but also the recognition of an award, which as you mentioned, is kind of secondary to the emotions that you felt and the feedback you got from people. But the award is well deserved and I'm just so proud. And it's the first of many, I think, from for you and for Patty and her group and hopefully for this show. But tremendous talent, as I've always said, you have tremendous talent, and I couldn't be happier for you and also for everyone involved. It's an awesome day and an awesome accomplishment. They can never take that away from you.
Hey, Joe, let me also add congratulations. Very well deserved. Terrific job. That was not only an Eclipse Award winner, it's one of the better pieces I've ever read about horse racing. And also, I want to point out, too, John Green, DJ Stable, owned Jaywalk, an Eclipse Award winner. I have been fortunate enough to win an Eclipse Media Award as well. And you too now, Joe. So we have a clean sweep. All three of us, the current crew of the podcast, are Eclipse Award winners. I think that's something we can all be proud of.
Eclipse Award winning TDN Writers Room is coming for all of us together. But thank you guys. I really appreciate the kind words. And that's very flattering from Bill, who's one of the best turf riders in America, for him to say that about my piece. So much appreciated for the support, you guys. I think of you as my older brothers since we've been doing this show. So it's gratifying to hear that from you guys. And again, I got to thank Patty and her team. They were such a big part of it. So the link is in my bio for the piece, but I'm going to toss it through the magic of Zoom podcast to the video that won the Eclipse Award.
The history of Belmont Park, believe it or not, goes back over 350 years to when America itself wasn't even an idea yet. In 1665, New York's colonial governor Richard Nickel created Newmarket, a racetrack in Queens. It stood for over a century and proved so popular that even when the British were expelled in 1783, a thirst for horse racing lived on in the hearts of newly independent New Yorkers. Union Course sprouted up in 1821 and became the country's leading track. After that came Brighton Beach Race Course, which helped create the New York Institution of Amusement at Coney Island, the plants of Sheepshead Bay, Gravesend, Jerome Park, Aqueduct, and many others followed soon after as enterprises competing to satisfy the city's enduring racing fix. Then, on May 4th, 1905, on a vast 400-acre expanse of land straddling the border of New York City and Long Island, Belmont Park opened. It was the very same land that Newmarket had sat atop hundreds of years earlier, but instead of a monument to British wealth and occupation, Belmont became an American treasure, open for all to enjoy, which they did by the tens of thousands from all walks of the now industrialized city. The attendance, moreover, was not restricted to any one locality nor to any one class. The Bowery and the Avenue mingled in the surging democracy of the betting ring, said the New York Tribune in its coverage of opening day. The Belmont Stakes, previously run at Jerome Park and Morris Park, moved to its permanent home later that spring. And over the past 115 years, legends were born and furnished in that race and at that track. Man of War, Secretariat, Seattle Slough, American Pharaoh, all had to come prove their greatness by passing the test of the champion. Beyond the equine performances, the track has seen the ups and downs of modern history and weathered every storm. The anti-gambling laws that shut it down for 2 years soon after it opened, the Great Depression, World War II, but nothing could prepare Belmont or New York City for what was visited upon it this spring. New York City is a gateway to the rest of the world, but this year that role cost it dearly as flights from Europe, packed with coronavirus-infected travelers, poured into the area by the thousands through March. It was a time bomb, and by early April, it had exploded. The biggest city in America screeched to a halt as everyone from the governor to the citizens turned their lives upside down and inside out to try to mitigate a horrendous pandemic that had already spread like wildfire. By mid-April, 800 of our neighbors were dying every single day, the equivalent of all the lives we lost on 9/11 every 4 days. The plague was so ubiquitous and murderous that freezer trucks had to be parked outside of our hospitals because the morgues had so quickly reached their capacity of bodies. Constant sirens from ambulances reminded us of the hell we were in. Going to the grocery store, a chore we never thought twice about before, suddenly meant taking your life into your hands. All in all, over 20,000 people in the city have been killed. That's more than one in every 400 New York City residents. And it's not over. But one thing about New York City that makes it special, that you can't understand if you haven't lived here, is that we look out for each other. We've proven it time and time again. We bounced back from 9/11 with solidarity and generosity and went about our lives. When outsiders predicted chaos, we took care of our city during the 2003 blackout and again through Hurricane Sandy. Crime plummeted just when the city was at its most vulnerable. Yes, there's bluntness and rudeness, and if you're a tourist, you might have been bumped out of the way once or twice by a muttering New Yorker. But there's also compassion, understanding, and empathy. You can't survive in a city of 8 million people without all of those attributes. We stared down the greatest existential threat to a city that's faced far too many of them. The devastation has been incomprehensible. I personally lost a friend. But we tamed the beast far better than projected, and we flattened the curve. Again, because we looked out for each other and sacrificed. Today, New York, after being the epicenter of the global crisis, is in a far better position with the virus than most of America. Because of that, we get a summer. We get to live our lives with reasonable precautions for the next few months. And amid a sports desert, racing has been an oasis. So it's fitting that on the first day of that summer, we get the Belmont Stakes, the first major sports attraction in New York since the pandemic first descended upon us. In my high school days, I would sit alone in the sprawling Belmont grandstand on a random Wednesday and just soak in the sights of a game that I loved. The bucolic serenity of essentially having the country's biggest racetrack to myself helped me clear my mind and battle the anxiety of a teenager growing up in post 9/11 New York. It was peace at a time when life in New York didn't have much of it. So it makes sense on a personal level that that cavernous track returns to provide peace in times of distress for the city once more. And even though we may not have the roar of the crowd this year, that just amplifies the sounds unique to our sport even more. The thundering rumble of hooves, the exultations of jockeys, the reverberating ring of the starting gate. Whatever lies beyond the horizon, we have reason to be proud right now, even as we mourn. Communities are what get humans through hardship. And through that hardship, those communities become tighter knit. It's happened in racing, and it's certainly happened in New York City. So you'll excuse me if I shed a few tears when those horses come out to that track to the echo of booming horns and Frank Sinatra's timeless voice. We've all earned the opportunity to let it out.
All right, so that's going to do it for the first TDN Writers Room of 2021, brought to you by Keeneland. Reminder that the Keeneland January sale is next Monday, January 11th, through next Thursday, January 14th. You can visit january.keeneland.com for more details. I want to thank Bill Finley, Dr. John Green in his lab coat, our Green Group guest of the week, Jim Gagliano, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Danny Seiper and Aaliyah LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask. We'll see you next week.